time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima.
Ich bin ein Berliner.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this.
The American people, I think, is good people. They have not to charge with the guilty of all the lies.
Welcome back to the Cold War show, big boy.
Thank you.
How's that middle finger going?
Doesn't smell right now. All good. Sorry. How are you?
Good. I'd like to give a shout out to, if he's listening, Professor Edward Watts's son.
Yes.
Professor Edward Watts was a guest on our Caesar show recently, and we had a bit of a lovely email exchange backwards and forwards afterwards. And yes, he said he's got a son who's really into the Cold War and was going to listen to our show. And I said, hey, got to warn you.
Warning. Yeah.
Warning. This show can get pretty nasty. And he said, my son will love it. He'll love it then. He's into that. He said, you know, I said there's a lot of swearing, dirty jokes, mature humor, and he said, oh, it can't be anything different to what he hears around our house. And I was like, you talk a lot about, I don't know, Churchill and Stalin getting naked, greasing up and butt-fucking each other in the back rooms of the altar conference. Really? Is that the kind of talk that goes on in your house?
Because if it is, I want to move in.
That sounds like my kind of household.
Get an extra room for us. Yeah.
I want to start this episode. We're still talking about the Korean War. Mm-hmm. I want to start by talking about the No Gun Ri massacre.
Right. Ironically titled. Yes,
because there were lots of guns involved. We have to go back a few months in our timeline.
Mm-hmm.
Because I only just discovered this. I only just learned about it because not surprisingly, doesn't turn up in your Western history books about the Korean War.
Right.
Partly because it only really came to light in 1999, although it was known about, denied up until the early 2000s. You know, we've talked over the course of the Korean series of the brutalities that both the North and the South were accused of. This is an instance where there was brutality very early on in the Korean War by American troops.
Right.
Against civilians and South Korean civilians. And, you know, this is before the Vietnam War. This is, you know, before, you know, the Korean War had gone on for, you know, years, as it eventually did. Mm-hmm. This is quite early on. But I think it's fascinating for a number of reasons. It gives us a sense of, you know, sort of not only how the Americans could be just as brutal as any of the other participants in the conflict, but also the way that it was denied by the Americans for 50 years until some intrepid journalists got enough eyewitness testimonies from South Korean survivors and Americans to who were there to make it undeniable. So on July 25th, 1950, North Korean forces seized the town of Yeongdong, which is, you know, one of your old nicknames I remember on various internet forums from back in the day. But
right. Now it's Hung Low. Go ahead.
Yeongdong is about 7 miles or 11 kilometers west of a place called No Gun Ri. Mm-hmm. U.S. troops were evacuating nearby villages. So July 25th, this is about a month into the invasion. I think the original, you know, and I've said before, we can't call it an invasion because you can't invade your own country. The excursion, the day trip, the
Civil
holiday,
War.
The sightseeing. Sightseeing, Civil War, okay. I think the North crossed over the 38th parallel on the 28th of June, so this is about a month later. US troops were evacuating nearby villages, and there was hundreds of residents from towns called Chugokri and Imkari. And these villages sort of join like this big village, this refugee train of people that are just walking south, I guess, trying to keep ahead of the forces from the north. And on July 25th, it's estimated about 600 refugees spent the night by a riverbank near a village called Ha-ga-ri, which is a few miles west of Nogunri. And then apparently about seven villagers strayed from the group during the night and US soldiers killed them. Not exactly sure why, whether or not they thought they were going to go and leak information to the north, or whether they thought they were, you know, guerrillas from the north or soldiers from the north. Something happened and they shot them.
If I could, real quick, just to give a glimpse into the American mindset at this point, we know that the war is not going well for the Americans. And just a day or two before this moment in time, the Americans had heard that a North Korean unit had broken through nearby. So the Americans retreat, regroup, kind of dig themselves in. So they're already expecting something really bad. And we already know and again, this is not excusing it, but their mindset is, oh my God, we're screwed, and they're hypersensitive. And so, yeah, when these seven people separate from the 600 mass, I think they automatically assume, aha, you are not, in fact, refugees. You are either you're spying for them, or maybe you are a North Korean soldier. And so, yeah, they were shot outright. And as far as I know, without any questioning, they were just shot.
Yeah. And as we've talked about in earlier episodes, there does seem to have been a deliberate strategy on behalf of the North where they would dress up their soldiers as civilians, refugees, and have them marching down the street, providing cover for the troops that were coming behind. So I can understand that the Americans were touchy, edgy, if they'd encountered this before. Then on the next morning, the 26th of July, villagers found that the soldiers, the US troops, had left. So they just continued down the road and then ended up getting stopped by American troops at a roadblock near Nogunri, where they were ordered onto some railroad tracks where they were searched. The US soldiers confiscated their belongings, including knives and things like that they had with them. Right. And then, according to one US veteran who was there, they were instructed to fire on everything, kill them all.
Right. And planes were strafing at the same time.
Yeah, well,
along the railroad
track. Story seems to be that the refugees were spread out along the railroad embankment around about the middle of the day when US military aircraft just came in, strafed and bombed them.
Yes.
A guy who was a 10-year-old boy at the time, Young Hae Chan, talking about it to journalists in 1999, said that the planes kept returning, just shooting, bombing, napalming. Chaos broke out among the refugees. He said, we ran around wildly trying to get away. He said he and another survivor saw soldiers reappear and begin shooting the wounded on the tracks. So survivors tried to hide underneath these railway tracks in like a culvert underneath them, but soldiers shot at them from there. They ran into a tunnel beneath a concrete railroad bridge, and then they were machine gunned by 7th Cavalry troops from both sides of the bridge. Another survivor, Park Sun-yong, whose 4-year-old son and 2-year-old daughter were killed and she was badly wounded, later said children were screaming in fear and adults were praying for their lives, and the whole time they never stopped shooting. Two US communication specialists, Larry Levine and James Crum, said they remembered orders to fire on the refugees coming to the 2nd Battalion command post from a higher level, probably, they thought, from the 1st Cavalry Division. they said they recall it being a frenzy of small arms fire.
Mm-hmm.
Some other veterans recalled frontline company officers ordering them to fire. An ex-rifleman, Herman Patterson, said it was assumed there were enemy in these people. Another guy, Thomas Hatcher, of the 1st Battalion, who was nearby, said they were dying down there. I could hear people screaming. The refugees began piling up bodies as barricades and tried to dig into or dig holes in the ground to hide. Some managed to escape that first night, but the US troops were turning searchlights on the tunnels, kept firing, according to Chung Koo Ho, whose mother died trying to shield him and his sister from the gunfire. By the second day, they were still doing it, but apparently it had been the gunfire had been reduced to pot shots, you know, when they were hunting down refugees. Some survivors also said planes returned the second day, firing rockets and dropping bombs. Survivors were reduced to drinking blood-filled water from a small stream running under the bridge. So, you know, look, I can understand maybe shooting men that they thought were communists in disguise, but the women and the children bit is pretty hard to justify by any sort of measure, unless you can think of something.
No, I can't. And also, when I first started going over this, I thought, oh my God, that must have been a horrible afternoon. No, this went on for 3 days. I mean, they were methodically going through piles of body, looking for survivors, looking for wounded, and trying to finish them off. That's the part, besides the women and children, that I don't understand. Clearly, you've broken this formation if it had been an enemy formation.
And declassified army intelligence reports show that the enemy front line was 2 miles or more from No Gun Ri on July 28th, right, the third day of the massacre. So, you know, it's a bit of a stretch to think that these were enemy combatants. On the night of the third day of the massacre, July 28th, the 7th Cavalry messaged their headquarters saying no important contact has been reported by our 2nd Battalion.
Right.
No mention of the killing of the refugees, at least in documents that have survived.
Yeah.
On the morning of July 29th, the 7th Cavalry Regiment withdrew from No Gun Ri, and later that day, North Korean soldiers arrived, helped those who were still alive, about 2 dozen people, mostly children, fed them, sent them back to their villages.
Mm-hmm.
The earliest published accounts of the killings from August and September 1950, two North Korean journalists who were with the North Korean troops estimated finding 400 bodies in the No Gun Ri area, including 200 seen in one tunnel. The survivors generally estimated the death toll at about 400. But as I said earlier, the general public, particularly in the West, didn't hear about this until 1999, when it was published in the media by three journalists, Sung Hong Cho, Charles Hanley, and Martha Mendoza. They later wrote a book about it, which I read, and won a Pulitzer for their reporting on it.
Right.
Now, the Associated Press also at the time published declassified military documents showing that U.S. commanders had issued standing orders to shoot civilians so as not to risk infiltration by disguised enemy soldiers.
Yeah, they said if there's a mass of enemy troops, or excuse me, if there's a mass or whatever of refugees coming right at the soldiers at your formation, then that is when you start firing, because obviously we don't want to fall for this again. So they did have orders. I think one was from Major General Hobart R. Gay. So they did have orders, but you're right, over the ensuing decades, a lot of that paperwork has disappeared because the military loves to document everything.
So, yeah, like it does seem to follow that these guys were given orders just to kill all of the civilians and make sure mm-hmm. there were no survivors, including children.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I don't know how you bring yourself to do that. I mean, I can imagine myself, you know, as an occupying invading force in a scary country, as a young man being attacked, you know, particularly not a lot of training in a foreign land, people speaking a foreign language, all very scary, losing my shit and you know, killing civilians if I thought they were, you know, disguised enemy combatants. But kids, women, kids, I'm not sure I could bring myself to do that under any circumstances, you know.
Yeah, shooting into a crowd is one thing. When it's day three and you're walking around kicking bodies, trying to see if anybody moves or if anyone's still alive, you've lost me there. And again, clearly your military objective of guaranteeing your safety has been accomplished. This is beyond that. I don't even know what words to use.
So when this came out in 1999, the Pentagon did an investigation into it, finally. In the year 2000, and the veterans of the 7th Cavalry that they interviewed estimated that the dead at Nogunri ran from, you know, dozens to up to 300. Homer Garza, who was a career soldier who was there, led a patrol through one tunnel, reckons he saw 200 to 300 bodies piled up there. In 2005, the South Korean government put together a thing called Committee for the Review and Restoration of Honor for the Nogunri victims, spent a year verifying claims through family registers, medical reports, other documentation. They certified the names of 150 dead, 13 missing, 55 wounded, and some of those then later died of their wounds. It's said, though, that reports weren't filed on many of the victims because of, you know, the passage of time and what was going on at the time. I mean, you know, it was very hard to, for the next few years, very hard to get anything done. And then, you know, if you lived in the South, the re-dictatorship was reinstated, you know.
Yes.
As we'll see later in the next few episodes.
Right. And the survivors kept their mouths shut because they knew better. So, and under the Ri government.
Under the Ri government, and, you know, it was a U.S. government, really. It was a U.S. puppet government, as everyone knew, both in the South and the North. Now, the thing is, you know, they have documentation now through stuff that's been declassified to know that news about the refugee killings actually reached U.S. command in Korea and the Pentagon by August of 1950.
Yes.
There was a captured North Korean military document that was translated that reported the discovery of the massacre. A South Korean agent for U.S. Counterintelligence Command at the time confirmed the North Korean account with local villagers. And high-level knowledge of it seems to have been around. It appeared in a New York Times article from Korea in September 1950 that reported that an unnamed high-ranking U.S. officer told the reporter of the panicky shooting of many civilians by a U.S. Army regiment in July.
Yeah.
But there's no evidence that either the high command in Korea, MacArthur's people, or the Pentagon made any effort to investigate it at the time.
Yeah, that's loyalty. That's team loyalty. You don't call it, what's Reagan's 11th commandment? I don't know the exact wording, but you don't tell on your own people. You don't criticize your own people. And that sounds like what's going on here.
Listen, George Bush Sr., I will never, when you guys shot down the Libyan aircraft or whatever it was, civilian aircraft in the late 80s, said, I will never apologize for America.
Right. Something like that. Now, what got me, now you quoted all these committees that were in South Korea and the reporters and the investigations. But what really got me was when Norman Tinkler, who was a machine gunner for the 7th Cavalry Marines, he said when he was asked, "We just annihilated them." I mean, he was given an order and they started firing and they were told to get rid of them all. And they spent 3 days just trying to do exactly that. And so when you have an American soldier just go, "Yeah, no, it happened pretty much just like you said it did or you think it did." I mean, that really shook me. I mean, it must have just been a hellacious moment for everybody. But now the Army has to cover it up. And it sounds like they did for a couple of decades.
Five decades of ignoring or dismissing the allegations, the U.S. Army finally acknowledged in the early 2000s that the U.S. military had killed, quote, an unknown number of South Korean refugees at Nogun Ri with small arms fire, artillery and mortar fire and strafing.
Mm-hmm.
However, it claimed and continues to claim that no orders were issued to fire on the civilians.
Right.
And that the shootings were the result of hostile fire from among the refugees.
Mm.
Hard to believe. From the kids? Like the kids were all armed with machine guns?
Right.
At another point, the Army suggested that the soldiers may have misunderstood the 8th Army's stop refugees order to mean that they could be shot.
Right. That's not how way orders work. That's not how the way it works in the Army. Sorry. Go ahead.
It also described the deaths as an unfortunate tragedy inherent to war and not a deliberate killing. No, we accidentally shot all those children, Commander.
Yeah.
The Army report also dismissed the testimony of its own soldiers who said they remembered getting orders to shoot.
Yeah.
Because, the Army said, none could remember the wording or the officer that they got it from or remembered having received the order directly himself. In 2001, Bill Clinton said he deeply regretted what had happened but didn't apologize for it. So after decades of dismissing claims that it happened, the U.S. Army finally at least officially confirmed it through Clinton, but denied that it was a deliberate result of orders. But, you know, I think this is just, this is classic America, man, like committing atrocities and then just denying it for decades, covering it up, denying it, and finally, even when it comes out, trying to spin it. Oh, well, yeah, okay, it did happen, but, wasn't not the way you said. It was an accident.
Right.
Yeah, of course, nobody was prosecuted, punished, like we're going through this in Australia at the moment. There's a big investigation that's going on here for many months about atrocities committed by Australian troops in Afghanistan. Because it's important that people who, if they're responsible for these sorts of atrocities, are penalised for it, and it doesn't get normalised in our military that you can do this kind of stuff and walk away from it unscathed.
Right. Well, there's a difference between I'm in a war, I participated in a war and it got ugly and civilians got killed and I'm sorry that happened, that just happens in war, versus our people can do no wrong. Why do we have to be morally superior to everyone all the time? Because then you're just digging yourself into a hole that you can't get out of. And yeah, you're going to have to lie for 5 decades. And it's eventually going to come out. All this stuff, does eventually come out. But it's trying to claim the moral high ground that confuses me. Just be honest. But that's just not the way we work, at least in this country. I'm sure other countries are the same as well. But we cannot be flawed, not unlike our founding fathers in any way.
Yeah, look, and we tend to associate this kind of atrocities by American troops with Vietnam in particular.
Yes.
There's been similar stories come out of Afghanistan and Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. But So it goes way back. It goes back way further than Vietnam. It goes back at least to Korea. And this is just one story that happened to get uncovered by journalists 50 years later. How many other of these incidents happened, incidences happened in Korea that we just don't know about because they got buried, covered up, and no one ever did? We don't really know. Anyway, so that's the No Gun Ri massacre story. Dougie Mac, meanwhile, as we said at the end of our last episode, has his big genius idea to land at Incheon, and literally everyone thinks it's a bad idea, a VBI, a very bad idea.
Right.
But he gave a big speech.
Right. But he,
apparently went on for 45 minutes.
Well, I thought MacArthur's point of view was absolutely brilliant. He's like, see, all of you are against me. I'm the only one who's thinking this is going to work. Maybe I'm a little crazy, but because everybody thinks it's undoable, that's exactly why it's going to work. You've got to trust me on this. I'm feeling the jazz. I'm like the A-team. You just got to trust me on this. It's going to work fine. Trust me. Hey, it's me.
Yeah, like his whole argument was, it's so crazy, it just might work, which you got to love.
Aha, million to one. Yeah, yeah.
So he gave this big speech to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, et cetera, et cetera. Part of it I have here, he said, it is plainly apparent that here in Asia is where the communist conspirators have elected to make their play for global conquest. The test is not in Berlin or Vienna, in London, Paris or Washington. It is here and now. It is along the Nak Tong River in South Korea.
Nice.
And then the it's so crazy, it just might work argument. The very arguments you have made as to the impracticabilities involved will tend to ensure for me the element of surprise. For the enemy commander will reason that no one would be so brash as to make such an attempt. I can almost hear the ticking of the second hand of destiny. We must act now or we will die. We shall land at Incheon and I shall crush them. Pretty good. It's like a Aaron Sorkin level speech, you know, it's or Oliver Stone anyway. We must act now or we will die. Afterwards, apparently the chief of naval operations stood up and said, General, the Navy will get you to Incheon.
And that's nice. He was the original drama queen. There's no doubt of that. Now, MacArthur's speech is fine. That's no problem. I love good hysterics or whatever. But what matters is what Truman wants.
But not everyone in the room was convinced. A couple of them continued to try and talk him out of it.
Right.
But it wasn't a complete rejection. And, you know, as far as Dougie Mac was concerned, anything other than an outright no was still a yes. In fact, I have a recording of his response to them when they were trying to talk him out of it.
I came a long way just to see you, Mary. Just least you can do is level with me. What are my chances?
Not good.
You mean not good, like 1 out of 100?
I'd say more like 1 out of 1,000,000.
So you're telling me there's a chance? Yeah!
The glass is half full, brother. That's what I'm always telling you. Unless she's pushing me off, I figure it's go time.
Yeah,
that's all
it's
I'm
funny
saying.
Because I wrote in my notes, so, it's kind of like your approach to women, Ray. If it isn't a no, then it's a yes. See, I know you that well. I know you that well.
Oh, and I apologize. I apologize every day for that. Again, I'm sorry. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, he got his way. So now that the White House has not stood up to MacArthur, probably because of his great hero worship that he earned during World War II, the White House doesn't say anything. And so on August 28th, the Joint Chiefs of Staff give this their blessing. The Incheon landing will go forward. This is going to be, hopefully, as far as MacArthur is concerned, one of the another great moment in his professional life.
But maybe. The Joint Chiefs also covered their asses. They got Truman to sign off on the plan. So they didn't have to.
Yes.
But they did, because this is their ballywick, but they got him to sign off. So if shit hits the fan, they're not carrying the can. Yeah. If shit hits the fan, I don't carry the can. Yeah.
Coffee mug.
Yeah, well,
coffee
Truman
mug.
Did have that little thing on his desk saying the buck stops here. So
that's right.
That's replacing the one that he had earlier, which was for when they dropped the A-bombs, which was
for
the,
a
buck,
good time.
The buck stops over there.
Oh, right, right.
That guy, I didn't. It wasn't my call. I just said, you guys, you know, you do whatever you think. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's not on me. Yeah. Well, what have I got to do with it? I'm just the president. I don't know about these things.
He should have said, I only dropped the first one.
That was on
the second one. No, I would have tried something. That was somebody else. That's on somebody else.
Sadly, in the 3 years that the U.S. had occupied Korea, no one had actually bothered to survey the country. So they had no idea.
Oh, is that important?
So they had no idea about the geography of the country, including the dimensions of the Incheon Basin and what they were going to be facing when they got there. Now, that's what you read in the history books, but I did some digging, scrolling through old newspapers.
Right.
New York Times in particular.
Right.
And I found a story from July 1949 in the New York Times that says a U.S. cruiser and two destroyers landed in Incheon in July of 1949 for a 3-day goodwill visit.
Sure.
Which is basically, hey, we're occupying your country now. Why don't you... give us
where
a little puntang. Where's the goodwill?
Right. Sorry.
Where's the drugs? Where's the hookers? or else, you know, things could get nasty. But if they landed a U.S. cruiser and two destroyers at Incheon, if they sailed them in, they must have known a little bit about what the harbor was like. To sail those ships in, right?
In my defense, Your Honor, it was a good day. The tide just happened to be up. I was shit-faced. I just did a line of coke off of Wusong's ass. I don't really remember that day, and I didn't write anything down, so I'm going to have to plead ignorance and cocaine on this one, Your Honor. They don't remember anything.
Ships in there, so they knew they could do it. Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, so the point is, for whatever reason, they decided to send in a man to take some measurements. Now, this guy is a complete badass. U.S. Naval Officer Lieutenant Eugene Clark.
Nice name.
It is a nice name. Did you read up on Eugene Clark's story?
No, fucking tell me. I'm ready. I got the popcorn. Let's go.
He wrote a book about it, which I read. But, you know, they're just like, Gene, here's your mission, should you choose to accept it. grab your measuring tape and your little survey.
No, the big one.
Your little survey.
The big one. Yeah, the big...
Matter of fact, you might need two. Get your little surveying tripod thing, you know, whatever that little camera thing is.
Oh, put it over your shoulder.
Yeah. We're going to just parachute you into enemy territory and want you to just take some measurements.
Typical Tuesday.
Just get back to us. He wrote a book in 1951 called The Secrets of Incheon, but interestingly never tried to publish it. Then he died in 1998. His family found it in a safe deposit box and published it posthumously in 2002.
Badass. Are you leaving anything in a safe deposit box?
Yeah.
Just curious.
I am.
some videotape.
Yeah, I deposit something in a safe deposit box every Tuesday.
No, I didn't say sperm bank. Don't worry about it.
Particularly, as you know, I'm getting this snip in a couple of weeks.
The snip.
My older boys keep saying, you know, you gotta put some in a cup, man. You never know, you might need it later on. I was like, listen, you want to know why I'm getting the snip? Just look in the mirror. That's like the world doesn't need any more of this, really. Quite frankly,
you're killing me, kids. I'm gonna go cut the lifeline.
Look at my hair.
Yeah.
Anyway, this guy, Clark, and yes. is a badass. He and two Korean translators
right.
Were dropped on Yonghang-do, an island about a dozen miles from Incheon,
mm-hmm.
which they used as their base. They spent 2 weeks there surveying the whole area, living on as little as 2 hours sleep a day, fighting off communist assaults.
Nope, I'm out.
Capturing enemy harbor craft, interrogating captives, who, by the way, confirmed that MacArthur was right, that the North Koreans apparently had no idea that Incheon was a potential target right. for a landing at right. this stage. They obtained exact information on the size of the city's garrison. They went into the city harbor in the middle of the night to measure the height of the sea walls.
Damn.
To determine whether or not troops and vehicles could get across the mud flats at low tide, to pinpoint the locations of dozens of machine gun nests and artillery emplacements on the fortress island of Wolmi-do.
Good name.
Which was at the mouth of the harbor. Now, is a good name, and they actually, while they were there, they did, you know, they had some spare time one night. They
right.
they wrote a song about the island, which I'm now going to play for you on my trusty Hohner harmonica that okay. I bought in. It was either Salt Lake City. No, I think it was Cedar City, Utah. Right.
Yeah.
About 10 years ago, I bought this little harmonica to, you know, because I was buying cowboy stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I got a cowboy hat.
Your face.
I bought cowboy boots.
Right.
And I thought, well, what else does every cowboy have?
That's a good point.
A harmonica. What am I going to play when I'm making grits over a campfire?
Love grits.
Yeah. Chasing off the coyotes.
So, you were a rhinestone cowboy. All right, I got you. Yeah, I got you. Yeah.
Here we go. Love me too. You say I love you. Let's all make a poo.
Poo.
So please, want me to? Oh, want me to? Yeah.
Nice, nice. Yeah. A lot of human excrement. Every song should have some of that in there. Anyway.
Finally.
Yes.
On the night of the invasion, right. Clark turned on the lamp in the lighthouse.
Sure.
On the nearby island of Palmy-do. It was a sequel.
Right.
It was a follow-up song. He tried to basically just ripped off the same thing and tried to put out a second single right. of Palmy-do. Right. Didn't work. People saw right through
too many
it.
Times like, to the on, whale. Dude, just, exactly.
Yeah, you're just rehashing.
Yeah.
You're just rehashing.
Don't do that.
We get it. Don't do that. Turn on the lighthouse to guide the armada up the channel to Incheon.
Right.
Like, this guy's fucking James Bond. I gotta yes. give this guy credit.
Predator.
Like, absolutely.
Yeah.
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 Like, oh my God, what a badass. Anyway, the opening to his book is pretty cool. I wanted to read a section from it.
Right.
He says, on August 26, 1950, I was summoned to the office of Captain Edward Pierce, USN, in the Daiichi Insurance Building in downtown Tokyo, overlooking Emperor Hirohito's Imperial Palace. For the past year, I'd been serving under Captain Pierce on General Douglas MacArthur's staff. Gene, Eddie Pierce said in his gruff, deadpan way, I believe we've cooked up a little rumble you're going to like.
No, thank you.
That's it.
Yeah.
A little rumble. Just you're a little. Like. We've cooked up something for you. A little bit of fun. A little bit of a day trip, day excursion.
Should have said Rambo, because that's what he's going to end up doing, living in the jungle for two weeks, knifing things. So
yeah.
Whatever. Yeah.
Fucking Rambo, yeah.
Yeah.
He writes, I was not completely surprised by Eddie Pierce's proposition. Since the war in Korea began, I'd been working in the geographic branch of General MacArthur's staff, gathering information about tides, terrain, and landing facilities at various ports along both coasts of South Korea.
Right.
I'd participated in amphibious operations during World War II, notably on Okinawa, the last big battle of the Pacific War, and knew what was needed to make a successful landing on an enemy-held shore. I and other members of my research team had scoured every possible source, from old Japanese studies to aerial photography taken during World War II, and had come up with very little that was reliable about either Korean coast. Yeah, what about the fucking guys that landed there a few years ago for a rub and tug, man? Like, you didn't talk to them?
They don't count. Again,
a rub and tug trip?
Again, cocaine cancels memory. We've been over this. Anyway.
The port was on Korea's west coast, 180 miles north of the Busan perimeter. If anything went wrong at Incheon, the American attackers... Oh, American attackers,
right,
would be in serious danger, yes, of being flung back into the sea with horrendous casualties.
Yeah.
The fighting men around Busan were too far away to give them any support. From my preliminary research, I already knew that the approach to Incheon was complicated by tides that rose and fell 29 feet in a 24-hour period.
Damn.
Leaving miles of mud flats. Some extending 6,000. You like some mud flats? I know.
I got some in my yeah, car. Continue.
Yeah, like,
you know,
I've got.
Oh, you got that? That's not the.
Oh, they're
same.
Mud flaps, not mud flats. That's what we call. Oh. We call them mud flaps here in Australia. Do you call them mud flaps over there?
I don't, but then again, I'm a Southern gentleman, so, and right, a closet gay, so I would know what to call them. So, anyway.
Really? You think you're closeted? I don't think.
I think anyone. Nobody suspects a thing. Continue.
Leaving miles of mud flats, some extending 6,000 yards from the shoreline at low water.
Damn.
I know we've gone to the limit in researching this matter, I said. So I take it that a little personal look-see trip is in order. Is that correct, Captain?
Damn, little look-see.
A little look-see.
Yeah.
Little look-see. Yeah. So he accepted the mission and lied to his wife about where he was going.
Sure.
As standard. You do in the long tradition of men lying to their wives about...
Anything. Everything.
Going.
Yeah.
Gonna go up, interestingly...
Right.
The two Korean translators that he took with him, he didn't tell them about the true nature of the trip.
Well, you can't trust them.
They thought it was just recon. Well, you can't trust your own allies, really?
You can't. Not really, really. I mean, okay, I'm going to whisper this so no one else can hear it. They all look the same. You can't, you don't know who. Come on, that's a Spycraft 101. You can't trust, you don't know who to trust, so you don't trust anyone. Not even his wife. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Well, I think you're right. He obviously didn't trust them. It was probably on a need-to-know basis, but...
Exactly. She did not need to know. Uh-huh.
Well, I'm talking about his Korean colleagues, but yeah.
Them too.
Gene confirms what we've previously said about the South's approach to the war, by the way. He wrote, "The Republic of Korea was waging total war against the Reds, admitting of no compromise, mm-hmm, utterly ruthless in her determination to expel the enemy and bring the nation together again under one flag. Korea was fighting this war under Oriental rules,
right,
with no pretense of observing the fast-becoming outmoded humanitarian laws of warfare established by Western conventions,
right,
except when they were shooting children under a bridge.
Other than that,
yes. Other than that.
Yeah.
And as so, like, just confirming again that it wasn't just the North that wanted to unite the country under one flag and that was waging total war.
Right.
The South was as well. And as we will see, after MacArthur drives the North back up north of the 38th parallel, he decides that he's going to reunite the country as well.
Yeah.
So everyone wanted to reunite the country. It's just that the North got started before everyone else did.
Yeah, they jumped across the line. No pun intended.
Or, right? You know, as we said in the during those episodes, by their account, it was the South that attacked them over the 38th parallel first,
which they did.
So they So they responded.
Yeah, a couple miles too. They actually penetrated a couple miles. I'm trying to remember now exactly, but yeah. No, this is nothing new.
Yeah.
This is just a bigger scale.
Yeah. So anyway, his mission, Eugene Clark's mission, confirmed the Navy's worst fears about the mud, the shallow water expending miles offshore,
right,
the high harbor wall that they were going to have to get up when they landed.
Yeah.
But what historians know now that mm-hmm. the US military didn't know at the time
right.
was this really wasn't a risky proposition at all.
Right.
Because the North not only had no idea this was coming,
mm-hmm.
they were seriously weakened at this stage of the war.
Yes.
As we've talked about, they had been severely damaged by the US and other UN troops that were there, and the ROK too. During the course of the war, the US had gone from seriously underestimating
right.
the strength of the North to seriously overestimating the strength of the North.
Yeah.
Remember back in the beginning, Dougie Mac, when the day trip by the North over the border first happened, over the parallel first happened,
mm-hmm.
Dougie said, "I can handle it with one arm tied behind my back."
Right.
He told John Foster Dulles that if he only gave him the 1st Cavalry Division in Korea, why heavens, you'd see these fellows scuttle up to the Manchurian border so quick you'd see no more of them.
Right.
That was in classic, American hubris.
Yes.
He was basically, give me one division, 1 week.
Yeah.
That's all it's going to take.
One condom.
They're going to run for the hills.
That's all I need. Yeah. So it's literally like they are totally beneath me. I can barely see them. To they are superhuman. We barely stand a chance. Because they pushed all the way down to Busan. So that basically the North Koreans had established psychological dominance over them. The Americans are like, we're barely holding on, we're barely holding on, we're barely holding on. And they're assuming the other guys on the other side shooting at them are now somehow superhuman. And this Incheon thing is so crazy, but it's the only thing we've got that stands any chance of us surviving this, because we're all about to be pushed into the water. So again, just these two extremes, and that's what panic does for you.
And with that kind of brilliant strategic mind that MacArthur had, that with one division he could win the battle in a week, it's easy to see why people may have been slightly skeptical about his plan for Incheon.
Yeah, good call.
A couple of months ago,
yeah, you said
you were telling me you needed one division in a week.
And now you've got...
Now you're telling me...
How many divisions? Yeah. 140,000 men plus are fighting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Make
up your damn
when
mind.
When you tell us, hey, listen, this is no big thing.
Yeah.
Ain't no big thing. We're like...
Pretty big. It feels big. Feels big. Like she said, feels big. I don't know. I wasn't there, but feels big.
Now... Something I want to remind everyone of, and I had to be reminded of this by one of the books I was reading.
Right.
We have to remember how racist Americans were at the time.
Yeah.
Like a lot of the guys that formed the U.S. troops over there,
mm-hmm.
Coming out of segregated American society.
Good point.
Where Koreans were people of color. Living, if they were living in the South, mm-hmm. Living in the US, where they were treated to apartheid-type restrictions, drinking from colored fountains in Virginia.
Right.
Couldn't marry Caucasians in the Southern states.
God, no.
Couldn't own property in the Western states.
Right.
This is in 1950.
Mm-hmm.
This was, you know, so you get a lot of sort of racist views who don't see people of color as fully human.
Exactly.
Or equal to the whites. And so no wonder, and obviously MacArthur seems to have been one of those, at least must have played part of his underestimation of the North Koreans in the first place. In the New York Times, when the war began, Hanson Baldwin, who's a journalist.
Good name.
Good name. Yeah. Wrote, "We are facing an army of barbarians in Korea, but they are barbarians as trained, as relentless, as reckless of life, and as skilled in the tactics of the kind of war they fight as the hordes of Genghis Khan. They have taken a leaf from the Nazi book of Blitzkrieg and are employing all the weapons of fear and terror." He wrote this 3 weeks into the war.
Right. Now, HR would have come in and said, "I'm sorry, but you can't do the Genghis Khan and Nazi thing all in one statement. That's just You crossed too many lines. But basically what they're saying in that statement is all of the worst parts of humanity or examples of humanity, these are what these people embody, and so we have to wipe them out. But again, just but you're right, they're subhuman, but they're but animals
barbarians.
But barbarians can be dangerous too. So where's the respect? Hmm. There isn't any until the Americans start getting their ass handed to them.
But you know I don't want to paint all Americans sure. with this brush, obviously. But you know, this is a guy writing in the New York Times, so the newspaper of record, as it's called.
Right.
So this must have been a fairly common view at the time, and so it wouldn't just be the North Koreans they would see as barbarians, mm-hmm. but the South Koreans they would have seen as barbarians as well, but and the Chinese,
our barbarians. So
yeah. But, you know, when you're executing children and women in train tunnels,
right?
If you think they're barbarians and they're not really humans, then
it's easier.
You know, it's like you're exterminating rats,
right.
like Colonel, what's his face in fucking shit, Tarantino's film.
Brad Pitt,
Hans. Yeah, Colonel Hans, you know, the other guy, Christoph Waltz's character.
Right. Oh, Hans, loved him.
Not Hans Gruber. That's a different cool movie.
Die Hard? Yeah, no.
But he talks about, right. When he's in the French guy's house
oh,
at the
yes.
beginning of the movie.
At the beginning.
Inglourious Basterds.
Yes.
And he's talking about, he hunts rats. The Jews are like rats and he's hunting rats. He's a rat killer.
Right.
You know, it's his nickname is the Jew Hunter, which is, you know, I think your nickname is what? The Jew Hammer? Is that right?
Yes.
I think,
yes.
It's same, but different.
Different enough. Anyway, I'm uncomfortable. Go ahead.
I can't really remember where the Jew Hammer.
When the
Jew Hammer.
When the
Jew Hammer, there's Pile Driver, the Sledgehammer, the Jew Hammer.
Okay.
Love the Jews.
My goal is to fuck so hard. Here I come, ladies. My stage name, bitch. Who the fuck are you? I'm going to fuck them all. Who's turned on? Who's turned on by this rope that you can't see that I'm pulling? It's my penis. Hambo, where you been?
I've lost the narrative.
According to Wilfred Burchett,
right.
the Australian lefty journalist who I've talked about before, the standing instructions of MacArthur to his Air Force were, anything that's moving, stop it. Anything that's stopped, move it.
I could follow those rules. Just two simple rules.
He also supposedly gave the order, any male person north of the battle line must be regarded as a legitimate target.
Right.
Now, I couldn't find those orders quoted anywhere else in my literature,
mm-hmm.
only in Burchett. So I'm not sure where he's getting it from, but I have to say that Burchett was obviously a highly credible journalist.
Right.
As we know, you know, his reporting on Hiroshima, et cetera, ahead of everybody else. So that, there's probably legitimate orders there,
mm-hmm.
but seems to be missing from all of the other Korean War history books and MacArthur biographies, et cetera. I don't know, when stories are getting around in the South that U.S. troops are executing hundreds of South Korean civilians
right.
under train lines, he's probably right. They probably were the enemy of all Koreans by this stage. He went on record, MacArthur this is, as having issued the most barbarous military order ever issued in the so-called civilized world. Just every male person is a legitimate target. Shoot everything.
Right.
Anything that's moving, stop it.
Yeah.
If it's true.
And again, you also got to remember you got to put it in the context of the panic early on in the war, for the first 2 months or whatever it was, the Allies were getting almost literally pushed off the peninsula. If it wasn't for the General Walker and his tough attitude at Pusan, that would have happened. So I guess you can have rules are nice in general, but when you're really losing and it looks like you're going to go down, are the rules in the way? And so you remove them and then you pick them up back later when you are no longer losing. That sounds familiar to me.
Psychopathic.
Yeah. But it happens. It happens.
But getting back to the point about their overestimation of the North Koreans' superiority, you know, right now, the opposite was true. At this stage, North Koreans' regiments were probably about 70,000 strong. Against a total, as you said, of about 140,000 US and UN troops.
2-1
In the country. Yeah. So, but they thought the North...
It felt like, Yeah.
So at this stage, the US possessed absolute command of the air and the sea, overwhelming superiority of firepower. And it seems like the North's intelligence operation was terrible too.
Shit. The complete shit. Sorry, that's the official category that it's in. Please continue.
The operation to land at Incheon was the worst kept secret of the war, so much so that that reporters were calling it Operation Common Knowledge.
Right.
And yet the North Koreans apparently had no knowledge of it.
Right.
There was no efforts to strengthen the communist defenses around Incheon in the days before the armada arrived there. There was about 2,000 poorly trained troops defending the harbour. For unknown reasons, they didn't even mine the port.
Yeah. That's crazy. Defense 101.
And so the first convoy of ships left Yokohama on the 5th of September. 260 or 261 ships set sail. That's some fucking armada.
And they had about 70,000 men in those ships. Of course, now, before you get all excited and decide to be impressed by that, just know that some of the people in those ships were just newly recruited, and they had to be taught basic tactical training on the voyage while they're throwing up because they're seasick. But still, it's a pretty impressive number. And when you throw that together with who's a General Walker, who's going to be pushing up from the south with 140,000 troops, again, this should not be the once-in-a-million chance that it seems to be. But again, because the Americans were so panicked, they thought this was something that actually may not work. And if it did work, it's because maybe God himself had smiled down upon them.
And by God himself, you mean Douglas
MacArthur. Exactly. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. The one.
Yeah. I mean, that's the big takeaway for me out of all of this is it's still talked about today like it was,
a brilliant
strategy.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Really, it wasn't. It was pretty straightforward operation.
Right.
If they'd had better intelligence on the weakness of the North Korean numbers and also the North Korean intelligence, it would have been a lay-down Mazaire. Everyone would be like, landed in China, of course. That's what we'll do. Yeah. Makes total sense, right? But at the time, they didn't know those things, so it seemed like it was crazy, bold, risky move. In reality, it wasn't.
This another D-Day. Yeah.
Now, this armada of ships sounds impressive. The ships themselves, not so much. They were old, rusty ships that were literally falling apart.
Antiques. They were antiques.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Some of the ships, tanks and vehicles broke loose. People are running around on the decks trying to re-secure them while they're smashing around on the cargo decks. Jeez. They hit a typhoon, which was creating 125 miles per hour wind.
Jesus.
Everyone's seasick. So just imagine 70,000 troops crammed below deck, throwing up on each other everywhere.
That's hot.
While learning how to load a rifle and fire it, which end that you point at the bad guys. Just...
Clusterfuck potential.
Clusterfuck. Yes. Yeah, complete clusterfuck.
Oh.
Imagine like sailing for days and days in those conditions, mm-hmm. sick as a dog. Then you land and everyone's like, right, now run, get off and run up run. The beach and shoot yeah, guys.
That's right. Fuck ugh. You. Ugh. And that is why we are podcasters. So.
yeah. yeah. You know, Mike, I've told you this story before, but my great-grandfather was a Gallipoli.
Really?
Landed at Gallipoli. Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And survived.
Good.
Only to commit suicide years later. But,
Jesus.
You know, it. So that I figure one beach landing is enough in my family. For
your, you're done. That's, check yeah, check
yeah,
that we, off.
We've done our bit. Right. Yeah, we've done our bit.
I got you. Yeah.
So on Wednesday, September 13th, four Allied cruisers entered Incheon Harbor,
mm-hmm.
and U.S. destroyers came in around it to shoot shit up.
Yes.
But I think that's where we'll have to leave this episode, because I think we've done yeah. sort of over an hour now.
So shooting ship shit up is where we'll leave off. All right.
Take care, buddy.
All right, you too.
Descended across the continent.